Unpopular opinion, but
Unpopular opinion.
You're listening to Unpopular Opinion, a podcast for professionals from all walks of life who want to hear success stories from innovators who've won by taking the path less traveled. In each episode, recovering journalist and content marketer Ashley Amber Saba interviews individuals who have prospered thanks to their genuinely unpopular opinions, despite warnings from naysayers, threats to their careers, and colossal obstacles. All rebels are welcome.
Welcome to Unpopular Opinion. I'm your host, Ashley Amber Saba, and this episode is brought to you by my friends at Audience Ops. Audience Ops is a content marketing agency, and they produce every episode of my show. If you're looking to launch a podcast for your brand or for your business, please let me know and I'll hook you up. Today, I'm joined by my actual best friend, Caroline Burton, fellow recovering journalist, sabbatical diarist, and marketing and communications freelancer. Caroline, welcome to the show.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Caroline, we are here to address the elephant in the room. You have taken a pause in your career. You are on a sabbatical that you are fully funding out of your own pocket. What led you to the decision to take this break, and what are you hoping to get out of the experience?
So for most of my adult life, I've kind of been the poster child for career over everything. Ashley's already told you that we're best friends, and so she would know exactly how many dinners I've missed because I was working late. And for me, that attitude really goes all the way back to my childhood. So we're roughly the same age. We grew up with media like Gilmore Girls, Legally Blonde, Devil Wears Prada, a lot of movies that suggested studying or working hard was the path to fulfillment and success. And so you may not come from a solid pedigree like Rory, or an academic background like Elle, or have the right experience like Andy in Devil Wears Prada. But if you work harder than everyone else, you can scale the ivory tower. And from a really young age, I internalized that. I think I started doing academic competitions in the third grade, and that turned into an obsession with achievement that's haunted my entire life. It was always about the next step. If I get this award, if I hit that milestone, the world will open up and I can finally be happy. I can be satisfied. But real life doesn't quite work like it does in the movies. Happiness is not an award that gets pinned on at a banquet. It's internal. And the decision to step back and redesign my life came when I realized that I was kind of like propping up my self-esteem with my career. I'd avoided the kind of internal work that really led to fulfillment. And when I made the decision to hit pause, I'd hit a milestone I was aiming for. I really wanted to get to director of communication before 30. But summiting that mountain, the result of 15 years of effort, because I've been writing since I was 15, it didn't make me happy. I just felt exhausted. The lifestyle I was chasing felt really hollow. That's also the year that my grandfather turned 90, and it's huge that I still have living grandparents. And I was just thinking, you know, do I have the time off to attend his birthday party? Am I going to be there for that? He lives a 10-hour round-trip drive away from me. Am I going to be able to be gone from my job enough to drive down there, throw a party, drive back, show up to work, and get the move on? I have years to pursue my career, but I realized then I don't have years to have dinner with him or go to his birthday parties. So time for change.
What kind of projects are you working on now, like in the interim while you're taking the sabbatical? Like what kind of things are you occupying your time with these days?
That was the first question my parents asked too. I think everybody was really worried that I was gonna like take a pause from my career and fuse myself to the couch. They were like, what are you gonna do all day? What are you gonna do all day? And that hasn't happened, partially because my brain needs a job to do. I'm a really active person. And partially because I knew that if I was going to really get the full benefit of this time, I needed to dedicate really intentional thought to burnout recovery. So I started studying, I started researching. How do you recover from burnout? How do you prevent burnout? How do you restore that feeling of desire, of motivation, of happiness in your career that I had been missing for a really long time? So, you know, I started off looking at the 7 types of rest, which is a framework by Dr. Sandra Dalton Smith. I think she presented this concept first in her book, Sacred Rest, and then she gave this great TED Talk. And in it, you know, she discusses rest, recovery, and burnout prevention. And the answer was that rest should be strategic and intentional, and that to really perform your best in any area of your life, you need to dedicate effort to rest and not just productivity, because one feeds into the other. And so I spent a lot of time collecting and implementing research on strategic rest and setting up systems in my own life that would increase my convenience on a daily basis. And then, you know, I've taken the odd freelance project. The desire was always to stay current in my career, which I'd always planned on returning to. And while I do freelance, that's not the most accurate title, because that's not what I'm devoting the majority of my days to.
It's funny that you and I are a lot alike, especially when you mentioned elementary school. That's like a competitive nature, and it's not even necessarily competitive against other people. It's almost like within you. Right. And then we found ourselves magnified into these like opportunities like journalism, where that kind of behavior of never being off fully and being on call all the time and whatnot, they're just expected of people traditionally in those kind of professions. And that's kind of what we fell into after that. And I do feel like the journalism and professions like journalism attract those kind of people, very type A people, people who are very inwardly motivated, people who do want to do as much as they can at their jobs all the time. But eventually, I don't think it is for most people sustainable. And we do pay for that in one way or another down the line, especially people who are in the profession for a long time. I mean, you and I both can think of somebody who had a family member even who was battling cancer and had to beg for time off to go be with them, which is completely unfair to ask of people. And in the end, a job is, like you mentioned, it's a job. Your family is your family. Your family is going to be there after your job, and at the end of your life, people aren't going to be talking about what you did for work, even if we think that's what, even that's what we imagine. Like, we're all going to have this tombstone at the end of our life that's like, RIP Ashley, you were amazing at content marketing. No, I mean, I don't even think half the people in my family understand what I do anyway, even though I want them to. But it's just funny how the type of people that end up in these kind of cycles, it's almost tough to get out of them in a lot of ways if we don't change what we're doing. And I like the fact that you've like proactively took it upon yourself to find ways to, you know, do active recovery, which speaks a lot to you being type A anyway. Like, you actually have turned this into a kind of another project in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think that's really true. So the thing about working in an industry like journalism that's kind of been imperiled is that understaffing becomes a revenue strategy for a lot of people. And the employees that remain are then tasked with picking up 2 and 3 areas of responsibility they wouldn't have been responsible for previously. They work longer hours because they can't afford to staff adequately and pay, you know, benefits and salaries that would contribute to lower workloads for the existing employees. And so it becomes this cycle of, you know, overwork, exhaustion, and you fall farther and farther behind in your personal life and in your personal time. And it just becomes this like negative feedback loop. I call it the productivity exhaustion doom loop. And the thing about that is the hidden cost of understaffing as a revenue strategy is retention. So we do know that retention is an extremely expensive problem for most companies from a staff training standpoint, from a productivity standpoint, from a recruiting standpoint, from an HR standpoint. It costs hours and hours of employee time when you get a turnover problem. And, you know, when you really think about it, the second you tell an employee you cannot be at your sick mother's bedside, the clock starts. You're going to lose that person. You're going to lose that position.
I completely agree. I think that there is been an uptick in employee well-being and employee experience being factored into a lot of jobs now. Now there are actually designated people kind of in charge of making sure that that is handled, which, I mean, if you would have asked me that, especially when I was in journalism, I would have looked at you like you had two heads. Like, what are you even talking about? Things like, I don't know, even like professional development plan. I was like, professional development, like I got to get the next deadline done. Like, what are you talking about? Nobody's been, no one's invested in that. Why would they care about this? They don't want me to do well after I leave this job. They just want me to be here. Oh, things are changing. It's the mentality. And I think the newer, like the upcoming generation, they're a lot different too. The Gen Z vocal crowd, they're like looking for, they're a lot more honest about what they want and where they want to be and what they expect of a job, and their expectations are just a lot higher for their employer than I could have even thought about, which is amazing.
Well, I mean, I think there's really a lot that feeds into that. So we collected a lot of data from the Great Resignation. So the job market we have today was obviously not the job market we had 2 years ago, when employees were in short supply and a million open positions spoke to the fact that people were no longer happy with the way that work was being conducted in our culture. And we were able to get a lot of data out of that towards the real cost of retention, towards what is it that creates employee satisfaction, what goes into a program for employee retention. And some of that's generational differences, and some of it, I think, is just the availability of data that we weren't collecting before, because it wasn't a priority before. We didn't have to worry about, can we keep people happy? It was, can we keep people in their jobs? And now it's, the answer to keeping people in their jobs is keeping people happy.
I love that take. I like how you're thinking of it in the data perspective on that too. Do you mind me asking how you are funding your sabbatical now? I'm sure a lot of people are probably curious how you're able to like make that happen for you.
Yeah. So that's not the first question I get, but it's always a question I get. And so the history of sabbaticals comes from academia, and academic sabbaticals were usually funded by the institution. As that spread outside of academia, we have a lot of different sabbatical options. Some companies provide them, some employees take them themselves. It varies person to person. My sabbatical is not employer backed. So I left the workforce and decided, okay, you know, I'm going to take this time. And when I come back, I'll have to look for a new job. And so when I had originally started this, I was anticipating a much shorter break. And I really wanted to make my life more convenient for when I returned to the workforce. One of those tasks happened to be consolidating accounts from the retirements I'd collected over, you know, 11, 12, however many years I've been in the workforce, and centralizing those into one institution so that I wasn't administrating like 16 different retirement accounts or whatever. And I looked at that and I said, if instead of rolling this over, I cashed out, I could fund a longer break and maybe really make some inroads on burnout recovery and designing new systems. And so the first thing I want to tell you is that if you do cash in a retirement amount or a retirement account early, there's going to be a tax penalty. So please be aware of that so that I'm not giving anybody bad advice. But I took one of those accounts and instead of rolling it over, I cashed it in. And my thinking was, I have all the time in the world to make more money. I'm 30 years old. My career is going to extend years and years into the future. But my grandfather turned 90, and I only have so many years to have dinner with him. And so cashing in that account became an investment in myself. I was able to pursue continuing education. I was able to look at, like we said, some of those systems that just weren't working in my life. And I was able to go to his birthday party. And I do want to give my partner so much credit, because when I said, hey, I really want to take a year off work, his first instinct wasn't, oh my God, no. He has completely stepped up. You know that I live in the US, and in the US, healthcare is provided through an employer. He put me on his healthcare provider insurance and is just taking care of that for us. And he's really stepped up his financial contribution to more than it was previously to support us while I do this. And so I'm so grateful for him for recognizing this isn't just an expense, it's an investment. And this makes sense for both of us. And the last thing I really want to touch on is my least favorite phrase. You deserve this. I hate you deserve this. Saying that what I'm doing right now is an immense privilege doesn't mean that I haven't worked really hard. In fact, I've worked multiple jobs for most of my adult life. It's an acknowledgement that life isn't fair and that a lot of people that do deserve the opportunity to what I'm doing, to do what I'm doing now, to pull back and reinvest in themselves, don't get that opportunity.
And I think it's very compassionate of you to think of it like that and acknowledge that too, because there are a lot of people in a different position that might not be able to do this, that should be able to, just because life is not fair. And
it's not.
It's just not equitable, not fair. And I think that, you pulling that out and acknowledging that is very important here too. Other than the fact that you had family members that claimed that they were afraid you might become a couch potato, which honestly, I can't even imagine. I can imagine you becoming like a garden potato, if that's such a thing.
potato.
Not that kind, but like the fact that you're out, maybe out planting things. You like gardening, you like taking care of things, you like nature, and things like that. Did you have any other kind of concerns that people brought up or just feedback that they got? Like, I would imagine one of the things, if I told people that, they'd be like, aren't you afraid that if you take time off, that when you go back to your job, people are going to be like, oh, what did you do with this gap? Like, did you have any other people mentioning things like that to you?
Yeah, so we know that employees are often expected to explain gaps in their resume if there's like gaps in their employment history. The fact that I'm so open about what I'm doing, there was no chance of hiding that or couching that. Or, you know, I think employers aren't going to look at this time and have questions about what I'm doing. I'm pretty open about it. But that absolutely was a concern. Does prioritizing myself and my mental health and my productivity signal to employers that I'm not a hard worker? And can I compensate for that? And so when I quantify what I've been doing on sabbatical, not only am I open about the fact that I'm researching productivity and burnout recovery, I did keep freelancing just to prove, hey, you know, I may not be on the 9-to-5 right now, but I've kept up with best practice in my career field. I've done some continuing education. I've done what I can to mitigate the anxiety that someone's going to look at that gap and say, oh, she's not going to work hard enough for us.
What kind of advice would you give other younger professionals looking to maybe emulate what you've done and take a sabbatical?
The first thing I really would suggest is to be really intentional about the time. Don't quit your job and fuse yourself to the couch, because not only is that rest type not going to restore your vitality and motivation, a sabbatical, the opportunity to really examine your life and take a step back, is a tremendous opportunity. You have the chance to put work into creating systems and creating a lifestyle and creating a different basis for fulfillment than you've ever had. Take the opportunity and optimize your future. It's not just about the now, it's about the next 5 years also.
I know we touched a little bit on your background, but can you fill people in just on what shaped your career up until now?
My villain origin story. So really, I think we can tie this back to doing academic competitions as a child. By the time that I was 18 years old, I'd performed something like 800 hours of community service. I'd volunteered for the UN Foundation to raise awareness of climate change. I was the editor of my school newspaper, and we had invented an entirely new advanced placement AP, for those of you familiar, class called AP Art 5 for me to take. I took both of these things thinking it would skew college admissions in my favor. And that was really the first taste of the real world I got, because I'd gotten this acceptance that I really wanted. I think it was Wesleyan. And I remember my dad sat me down and I could see how much it hurt him to have this conversation with me. And he said, "I'm so proud of you. You've worked so hard, but you can't afford this." And instead of bowing to reality, I took that as a challenge. I thought, if I can make enough money, get the right combination of awards and recognition, no door is ever going to be closed. And I'll finally be happy once I have my pick of opportunities. But the reality is, all I got was this dumb t-shirt and a serious case of burnout.
I love that. Can you talk a little bit about your transition from journalism to communications?
Ooh, okay. This is a fun one. So I don't know how dialed in your audience is to what's going on in the journalism industry right now, but I do know that a lot of former journalists do make the transition to some kind of marketing or public relations just because it's a transferable skill set. The journalism industry faced a major crisis when the funding model for advertisement shifted with the availability of information online. So journalists used to perform a kind of gatekeeping opportunity, and that was connected to paywalls and salaries and how our society consumed credible information. When online news sources became a thing and Facebook became a thing and we stopped associating information with news organizations being kind of this gating entity, the bottom dropped out for a lot of companies that formerly provided news coverage. I was a print journalist, so that meant I worked for newspapers. I started off as a reporter and I ended up doing graphic design. And the funding model that supported that failed. Advertisements pulled out of print newspapers. The industry shrank and shrank and shrank and shrank. And anybody that was left not only became a generalist, because you were wearing, again, two and three hats to support the fact that staffs had shrunk to such a degree, and you worked really, really, really long hours. And so at a certain point, it became unsustainable. Not only was I not there doing what I'd set out to do, you know, providing these stories that connect people to their communities and connect people to other people, because there just weren't the resources to provide what it was I'd set out to provide. You know, the long hours, the low pay, the lack of benefits. As I became an adult, those things became more and more important. And as I developed family commitments, I'm married now, it just became necessary to do something else to support that. And so I looked to my transferable skills and I decided, okay, I think what I want to do is look for a director of communications position, and that'll use some of my core competencies. Here's the experience that I need to get to level up to that position. And then I spent the next several years hunting that experience in different positions. I've had what you would consider a non-linear career path. So taking jobs that on their face may not sound like the correct titles to progress up, but included skills that I knew I needed to increase to eventually get that title. And I did get there. Before I took my sabbatical, I was a director of communication.
And it doesn't shock me at all that you got there. Perfectionist. But just for a minute, I want to take a quick moment to thank the audience ops team for producing this podcast. They make it easy for people like me to focus on interviewing amazing people like Caroline. And without them, I wouldn't have this show, because I just wouldn't have the bandwidth to get the production and the social media graphics and things done. Anyway, if you are looking for help with any of that, I am happy to make the connection. Right, back to you, Caroline. Can you elaborate on what you have told me before, that why you believe that PTO is not the enemy, but wasted hours on the clock are the enemy.
Yeah. So I think this really ties into the whole, you know, return to office, work from home debate. So it has to do with how people really work and how people really work most productively. We've all heard the statistic that humans only really contribute about 3 hours of productive labor in an 8-hour workday. This number comes from a Bureau of Labor Statistics study that polled American office workers and found that actually the vast majority of time spent at work was devoted to activities like reading news websites, checking social media, having discussions with coworkers. Some of this has to do with attention spans and how people do their best work. And some of it has to do with American work culture and traditions. So the 8-hour workday doesn't come from modern data about increasing people's productivity. It has its roots in the Industrial Revolution. So when we look back to the late 18th century, it was 10 to 16 hour workdays were the norm in factories. It was eventually acknowledged that this pace was unsustainable, high rates of injury were common, and advocacy began with labor leaders who were advocating for shorter workdays. We probably get the 8-hour workday from Welsh activist Robert Owen. He became famous for the slogan, 8 hours labor, 8 hours recreation, 8 hours rest. We didn't really see that attitude become standard until the 1900s, when the Ford Motor Company both cut hours for its factory workers to 8 and then doubled wages. The result for them was that productivity skyrocketed. So that's really where we see the 8-hour workday. And we haven't really changed anything since then. There are other factors that influence productivity apart from attention span. There's a phenomenon called task initiation paralysis. This is sometimes associated with executive dysfunction. This has to do with how difficult it is for people to start a new task, particularly a difficult task or one they might be dreading. And then we also have to consider the reality of multitasking. So a variety of research suggests that multitasking is not actually possible. And we lose productive minutes attempting to switch our attention from task to task to task to task. And so this idea that the enemy of productivity is employees taking time to themselves or working intuitively or figuring out what works best for them and pursuing productivity that way. And instead that the metric is face time, time spent staring at a computer until they're finally able to make that breakthrough, that became the standard of how well your office is doing. And so think about it. How many hours have you spent in an office surrounded by beige walls, staring at a computer screen, hoping beyond hope that idea was just going to pop into your brain?
Oh,
and
wow.
How many times did that really work?
I feel like, I mean, you and I would say we were quote unquote hybrid before it was cool, because we would have to do on the go, you know, reporting and things like that. And you kind of had to get things done where you were, and then you would go back to the office and do production and whatnot. But when I went into corporate America, I found it difficult to come off like I wanted people to know that I was doing my job. But a lot of the times what I was doing on my job look differently than maybe what they did all day. And it was because I need to, like, theoretically, I need to, like, walk around and get a coffee and think. I can't get things done if I'm looking at a computer all day. And I would look around me in corporate America and it looked like everybody was doing things all day. They were thinking all day. They were on the computer all day. They were typing all day. Did I look at their screens at what they were actually doing all day? No, but it made me feel like I wasn't doing what I should be doing, because how I do things didn't look like how everybody else was doing them. And I feel like going, for me at least, going either hybrid, back to hybrid, or going remote fully makes me more productive, because I don't have to look like I'm being productive all day, which I don't know why I felt like that pressure to do that. But I was like, if I don't look like them, then they're going to think that I'm not doing anything, even though I needed that time to think. And I don't know, the time to think for me isn't coming or best spent like at a computer a lot of the times.
Well, and you know, if you were able to say peek over that coworker's shoulder, what are the chances they were actually working on a work product? What are the chances that they weren't checking social media or scrolling a news site? The thing about productivity is, especially when you do what we do, which is creative work, is that an important component of that is inspiration. Inspiration doesn't come from beige walls. Inspiration doesn't come from staring at a blank Google document for 4 hours. That's wasted time for your employer. They're paying you for those hours when you are actively prevented from being productive by not working in the way that suits your personality type. And lately, you know, this is where the conversation about neurodivergence enters the chat, because it's become apparent that a variety of neurotypes have a variety of working styles and preferences as to what works best for them. It's not a factory where one part goes into one other part goes into one other part. It's not standardized. People have different needs and abilities, and management really doesn't do a good job in America of recognizing that, of realizing, you know, we maybe need to look at this a little bit more individually.
I know you talked a little bit about this, but I have a difficult time when I'm in, going from meeting to meeting, especially if the time between the meetings is like 15, 30 minutes only, going to the next project. And I don't think that I'm alone in that by any means, but I was wondering if you, along those lines, have any kind of practical steps that individuals can take to minimize like wasted hours and maximize their productivity without being like me, having a hugely tough time just like getting back on task after a meeting. I've had issues doing that for my whole career.
Yeah. So I'm going to answer this question with another rest reference. So if we look at the 7 types of rest, there are different types of rest that an individual needs in order to be their most productive self. Among those are creative rest, which includes getting inspired to refill your well of innovation and creativity, and mental rest, which will help you transition between tasks by reducing fatigue. If you're really interested in incorporating rest into your workday, I encourage you to look at the Pomodoro technique. It's a technique that prioritizes strategic rest to help you refresh as you're working through difficult problems or a long day. So again, staring at that blank computer screen only gets you so far. If you take a minute, stop, take a brief walk outside, sit in the break room for a couple minutes, look at something else, it'll actually help you continue as opposed to just staring at that blank screen.
I'm going to have to check that out. It sounds definitely valuable for me on there. I like this other unpopular opinion that we talked about, which was you believe that America, our work culture, has a passive aggressive problem. How can passive aggressive behavior impact workplace dynamics and overall productivity from your viewpoint?
Okay, so here's another difficult topic for a lot. We're going to have to talk about quiet quitting. Maybe the worst branding of all time. Quiet quitting, as we understand it, is not actually quitting your job. Quiet quitting is defined by most of the people that talk about it as performing to the stated expectations in your job description. So it's not actually quitting your job. It's performing as you've agreed to do when you sign your functional job description, when you agree to work for a company. And here's where the passive aggressive component comes in. If the metric for performance at your job is based on unspoken expectations, if that is not outlined in your job description, but you're still expected to recognize what that is and go the extra mile just to meet expectations, that's not a realistic standard. The problem is people can't perform to unspoken expectations effectively. Companies really need to look at those job descriptions and outline what is expected and what an employee needs to do in the average day to, again, hit that standard of meeting expectations. And going the extra mile really needs to be going the extra mile, going outside of your job description and performing that extra work that supports what you might consider real excellence, or, you know, taking extra effort for your job. And that needs to be returned to what it really is.
I feel like that's good advice for relationships too.
Yeah.
We expect if you're in romantic relationships, especially, you expect your partner to just know like what it is that you want them to do. And if you want them to go like above and beyond, and they have no idea because they cannot read your mind. And that's just
So that's where passive aggression comes in, right?
Yep. Like,
you're mad at somebody for not doing something that you never told them that you wanted them to do in the first place. You gotta make that expectation explicit or nobody can meet that.
Exactly. You've said that face time is not the metric of success, and that project outcomes are, which I totally agree with. But what challenges do you think shifting that focus from face time to outcomes will be for organizations, and how can they combat them?
Yeah. So again, we're going to talk about like understaffing as a revenue strategy. At a certain point, leadership development stopped being its own thing, right? So nowadays, a lot of people come to management roles just because they're good at their job, not because they've received specific training in leadership or emotional intelligence or managing employees. And we've really done ourselves a disservice here because management and emotional intelligence are their own skill sets. And so we treat management, again, with this outdated factory mindset, like one strategy is going to work for all the people you manage. When the reality is that isn't true, you are probably managing a plethora of personality types and neurotypes and people that have different needs. And you really need to be able to understand the way in which they work effectively to manage them well. And so just having all of your employees gather under your watchful eye and stare at a computer for 8 hours, that's not success. In fact, you're probably wasting company dollars on unproductive time. You're paying them to scroll news websites or check their socials. You know, again, we look at that Bureau of Labor Statistics study. And the real metric of success shouldn't be how many hours you can stare at a computer screen. It should be how much productive work can you accomplish and what are the outcomes of the projects you work on, not just how many hours did you spend in the office trying to finish.
How can organizations do a better job of striking the balance between just following necessary processes and fostering a solutions-oriented mindset?
That's a really great question. I think it comes back to trust. So we talked a little bit in the last question about what it really takes to develop an effective manager. And an effective manager is not somebody that treats their employees with a one-size-fits-all mentality. One size doesn't fit all. We know that. A real focus on the solution, on project outcomes, which is what we're really paying for when we look at budgeting for employee time, is individual. You need to know your workers, the people that work underneath you, understand how they are most productive, and manage to that standard instead of some arbitrary industrial revolution hourly standard that has no real basis in modern statistics.
I kind of wonder if that comes down to just lack of experience too, because if we don't know what people should be doing, we just want to make sure that they're in there long enough and they're checking off boxes and things like that, which I do think plays into what you talked about on just leadership and the fact that to get to the next level in a job now, we're just expected to become a people manager and that's how you get paid more, but they're not developing the people with the skills that they need to be good at doing their jobs and be good at understanding their people. And then we get upset that the organization is failing. And it's because the people that are leading people are having turnover because of things like that. And a lot of people, I don't know anybody who would be like, oh man, I wish I had a micromanager of a boss. I don't think that is out there for the majority of people. I don't think nobody is looking for that, but you end up with a lot of teammates that at least I've heard before that they had managers who just checked in with them and asked what they were doing like every hour of the day. That way they knew what they could report on to their upper management, who probably didn't want to know that, that probably did just want the solution and the big picture, but they just don't know what they're doing. Oh, that's a good way for them to be like, well, employee A at 2 p.m. turned in this report, and at 3:15 held a meeting for their department. I don't know if that's what it is, but I think that it definitely factors into that whole scenario.
Yeah. So if we go back to this whole shrinking staffs issue, management used to be its own job. Now you're not just a manager, you're usually whatever you were before you were a manager also. So say you are head of content. You're not usually just responsible for a stable full of content producing employees. You're usually responsible for also producing content yourself. And that really reduces the time that you're spending on leadership training and development and managing those employees. In a certain sense, you almost have to standardize your approach just because you don't have the number of hours required to do both jobs. Or you can work outside your salary. People compensate for this in a variety of ways. But what it comes down to is one of those things is not receiving your full attention. Was it Ron Swanson that said, don't half-ass two things, whole-ass one thing?
That's him.
Yeah.
That's my man.
We're half-assing these multiple hats because we don't have the amount of time necessary to perform each role to its fullest degree. And to fix that problem, we really need to look at effective management and leadership development as what it is. It's its own job.
Amen. Okay. I ask everybody who comes on my show to debunk an unpopular opinion, and I would love to hear one of yours.
The hidden cost of understaffing as a revenue strategy far outweighs the benefits of pursuing it.
Bam, mic drop. You just nailed that one. Do you have any other things that you want to leave with the audience today, coming from terms of sabbatical or just mental health or anything like that, before I ask everybody where they can go to find out more about you and get more Caroline on their feeds?
This took me way too long to learn. Money isn't lifestyle. Lifestyle is lifestyle. Money can give you choices, but it can't replace the things you need to keep yourself mentally healthy. And if you throw yourself at the acquisition of wealth, but neglect your mental health, you're not going to come out on top. Because eventually, you're going to hit a point of burnout. And once you hit that point, something has to give.
I think we both have figured that out one way or the other. That was a good one, Caroline and Ashley, takeaway for sure. All right, where can people go to find more Caroline?
Hey, right now you can follow me on LinkedIn, where I, hang on, let me redo that one. So next week, I'll be launching a collection of research and resources based on the work I've done personally to recover from burnout. You can look for it on my LinkedIn, where I share my thoughts about productive rest, work cultures that alienate employees, and burnout recovery.
Hell yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to that. I've loved following what you've been doing up until now on LinkedIn, just sharing your tips and what you've been up to. Loved your photos from your Europe trip. It's been amazing to keep up with you now in another platform, because just having you in my life wasn't enough. I needed to have you virtually too. But anyway, thank you so much for coming on my show. And it was cool to do a professional feat with you again. I don't think we mentioned this exactly, but me and Caroline actually worked together in the same company before. And that's how we met many, many years ago.
Yeah, we are ex-colleagues and current best friends.
Yep, it can happen, people.
It can happen.
It's possible. Maybe that's the unpopular opinion.
Yeah. Do we have time to talk about trauma bonding?
Oh yeah. That could be a whole new episode. If we ever bring you back on the show, or if you have your own show one day, that would be a whole, that would be a whole nother topic. I'm sure that we can get into that one. Well, thank you again for coming on my show. I hope you have an amazing day, and I'm sure we'll be talking like we do almost every day.
Oh. Bye guys.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Unpopular Opinion. This episode was produced by Audience Ops. If you're looking for help launching a podcast, Audience Ops handles all the legwork so you can focus on providing the subject matter expertise. If you enjoyed this episode, please follow Ashley's show on Spotify, Apple, or YouTube.